The following is an AZPM original production.
For AZPM, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, Danielle Camara talks with Lise Doucet, the chief international correspondent for the BBC, about her 40 years of reporting from deep inside some of the world's most dangerous conflict zones. Nature essayist Rebecca Doyle shares her love for autumn among the aspen trees. And birding enthusiast Richard Catcher Taylor talks about the research behind his book, Birds of Arizona. Those stories are next on Arizona Spotlight. Next, AZPM's Danielle Camara talks with Lise Doucet, the chief international correspondent for the BBC. Doucet visited Tucson to receive the 2024 Zanger Award for Press Freedom from the UA School of Journalism. It's in recognition of more than four decades of Doucet's reporting on armed conflicts and human rights around the world. As you listen, keep in mind that this interview was recorded a few days before the 2024 U.S. presidential election.
Just looking back on the last 40 years, like you've done so much, you've covered so many important events. What do you feel like is some of the impact of your work?
Journalists, sometimes we get fired up by this ideal that we can somehow change the world, that when people see or hear or read our reports, that the power of our reporting, you know, on the ground in the heat and the dust and the dark and the chill, that they will be moved to do something. Mm-hmm. And sadly, the history of the world is that it doesn't always do that. But I think in all the years of reporting, I've come to believe in the power of stories, that stories is really what makes us who we are. It's our history, it's our present, and it's also our future. And to be able to tell the stories that matter in the world, which are human stories, no matter how political they are, when you drill down, it is human stories. Yeah. That is such a huge, huge privilege. You know, when you look at investigations, like what happened with the New York Times journalists about the Me Too movement, when you look at now one of my colleagues who's done an investigation into Abercrombie and Fitch, which has led to allegations of sexual improprieties and court cases. I can't think of a single one where I turned the world upside down, but I have come to believe that person by person, story by story, that stories can move people. And even if it causes them to ask questions, think differently, become more interested, that it's something that over time, there's a collective impact. And after decades of reporting, for me, the most important thing is that people still keep listening, and that I'd like to believe there's some respect there. And for me, I don't know whether you'd agree, to be respected for what you do as a journalist, I think is one of the biggest accolades of all. Very hard to obtain, very easy to lose. We always have to watch our words. I remember after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, and I'd be called up for interviews, and people would ask, well, are you scared? I mean, the Russians are literally at the door. And I would say every morning, the only thing I'm afraid of is getting something wrong, getting a word wrong, a fact wrong, something in history wrong, a prediction wrong. Just every day, and I'm sure we all do it, is we get up and we say, just every day is a new day, a new story. I'm a journalist. What a privilege, but what a responsibility too.
As a female journalist covering conflict zones, has there been a lot of times where you did find yourself as the only woman or one of the only women? Did you ever have problems, and how did you overcome them?
For example, sometimes going to the Islamic Republic of Iran, you know, sometimes Iranian, I remember conversations, I can just see it in my mind's eye. I used to describe it as being colorblind. They couldn't understand. They'd say, so you're traveling around the world by yourself? And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, and you're not traveling with a husband? Or no. I could just see their face. They didn't understand it. They didn't see these same colors, but they were very, very curious. In very, very conservative societies, we weren't treated like the women of the societies who lived under many, many restrictions. But we weren't treated like the men either. We had this special status. And I used to laugh about it sometimes to myself in Afghanistan, because it meant that within Islam, and of course we see today the Taliban of Afghanistan take it to extreme lengths. They say, well, we're protecting women. So during the Cold War in Afghanistan, during the Soviet occupation, when you would travel with the government, when you see the woman coming, oh, you must take the front seat in the helicopter. Oh, you must. And I think, oh God, I don't want to be in the front seat of the helicopter if it crashes. So they would take care of you. So I think if I was to resume it, I would say it's been more of an advantage than a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And of course, some, you know, and some people are very open about it. Some women, you see prominent women singers and others who say, well, that men don't really expect anything from them. So they mm-hmm. take advantage of it. We shouldn't mm-hmm. be saying that the male listeners, we're telling all our secrets. They don't see you as threatening. So they end up telling you, you know, all their secrets, saying, oh, she's just a woman journalist. I don't take advantage of that. But I think just professionally, it has offered more advantages than disadvantages. It is true that in some societies where access to women is controlled by the men, and where the stories are deeply, deeply intimate stories about rape and other crimes against women, which of course doesn't just happen to women, it can happen to men too, but in the case of when it happens to women, that women feel more comfortable speaking to women about it, because often these are societies where women, you know, sadly, even to this day, have no contact with men outside of their immediate family. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder for them to be able to speak to men. So there are those moments where it's easier sometimes for a woman to do those stories mm-hmm. than for a man to do those stories. And right now, the world in which we live, the human stories of war are the main stories of war, because the nature of war has changed. I mean, it's an astonishing moment in world history where the wars of our time that we see unfolding in Gaza, in Ukraine, in Sudan, they include both the wars of centuries past, like you see trench warfare in Ukraine, you see siege tactics going back to medieval ages in some wars, but you also see the most advanced, these new drones, cyber attacks, all the most advanced state-of-the-art weaponry and intelligence gathering that we didn't see in previous wars. And so these are the wars of our time. And these are wars in which the front line runs right through towns and neighborhoods and streets, and sometimes right through houses. And I often say that, you know, the world in the First and the Second World War, they used to talk about the women and children first. You have to protect the women and children. Well, women and children are no longer near the front line, on the front line. They are the front line. They are being targeted, deliberately or not, in wars of our time. So they are the main story. Yeah. And women are covering them and men are covering them, because they have to do them if they're covering the story.
I also wanted to ask if you could talk to us a little bit about the coverage that you've done. Like, what is your viewpoint right now about the coverage that you're seeing coming out of Gaza?
In the first days, weeks, and to this day in this war, which is now more than a year old, we keep using the word unprecedented, because this war is unprecedented in every single way, and in horrendous ways it is unprecedented. It's unprecedented for what is happening on the ground. It's unprecedented in terms of the history of journalism. Unprecedented, of course, because on October the 7th, it was the most deadliest day for Israel, the greatest loss of life in a single day for Israelis, the highest number of deaths, more than 1,200, the highest number of hostages, more than 250, something which sent a chill down the spine of an entire nation. And to a person, Israelis say it changed their country forever. But since that day of unprecedented horror for Israelis, we have seen unprecedented suffering and deaths among Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, record number of deaths. Now what's happening in Lebanon, again, to use that same word, unprecedented. And that people are seeing things, you know, aid agencies, whenever they go to Gaza, aid officials who have decades of experience say, I knew it was going to be bad. I have never seen this extent, this depth of destruction and devastation and desperation anywhere, ever in my career. These are intensely painful times for the people on the ground. They're intensely challenging times for the journalists, because it is unprecedented. It's not the first time ever in a war that journalists have been prevented from going, but it is unprecedented for a major war in a country like Israel that we are being prevented from going to Gaza to see for ourselves with our own eyes and ears exactly what is happening. We are depending on the reporting of Palestinian journalists whose reporting is nothing less than heroic. They are not just reporting on a story. It is the story of their own lives and their own families.
To wrap up, I wanted to ask you about, like, what are you working on right now that you can talk about? Like, is there anything that you're excited about or looking forward to getting out there? I know it's hard to be excited about some of the topics that you cover.
Well, but since I'm in the United States of America, I called my editor before I came. And when I leave here tomorrow, I'm going straight back to Israel to see what the impact of the American election, your elections, will be on the Middle East. So I said to my editor, so how long should I stay in Israel? Well, depends what happens in the American elections. So after that, I'd like to go to Afghanistan because I've been delaying. When should I go? Well, depends what happens in the American elections. So I feel my whole reporting is on hold until we see what all of you do, how you vote in the American elections.
And what are people saying? What are you hearing in Israel and the parts of the world where you've been talking
Everyone's
to people
watching.
About this?
Everyone's on tenterhooks. I often joke, and it's not necessarily a joke, that we should all vote in the American elections because they have an impact on all of us. And I was reading an article this morning that, you know, Latin American media are covering it because it will have a huge impact on migration, whoever wins. The Middle East is watching because it will have a huge impact on the course of the wars in Lebanon and in Gaza and beyond, depending on who wins. Europeans are watching closely because the future of NATO, the future of global alliances could be on the line. So it's only days to go and we're all watching. Yeah. So, and after that, I mean, obviously the wars in the Middle East are the, for journalists like myself who cover the main stories for a major global broadcaster, I'm going to keep following that story. But I also want to get to the stories which have been eclipsed by what's happening. Stories in Sudan, where it's horrendous there, to what's happening and the world is not paying enough attention to it. What's happening in Afghanistan, which has completely slipped from the eyes of the world. And how can any of us accept that we live in a world where girls cannot go to school, go to high school, where women cannot go to university, where women can't even go to public parks and women's only gyms? These are stories that, as journalists, we have to keep telling those stories, because those are stories that matter not just to whether it's Afghans or Sudanese or Israelis or Palestinians, they matter to all of us. They are our stories too.
That was Danielle Kamara talking with Lise Doucet, recipient of the 2024 Zanger Award for Press Freedom from the UA School of Journalism. After what has seemed like an eternity, the temperatures have finally dropped in the Tucson Valley, and an approximation of fall has begun to be felt just in the last 2 weeks. Next, an essay by author and listener Rebecca Doyle. She originally hails from Rhode Island, but she now possesses an overflowing appreciation for Sonoran beauty, and, as we'll hear, the arboreal splendor that can be found at slightly higher altitudes. Rebecca Doyle is an outside contributor to this show, and her opinions are her own.
In October 1841, the British author George Eliot wrote to her friend and former teacher, Miss Lewis, "Delicious autumn, my very soul is wedded to it, and if I were a bird, I would fly about the earth seeking the successive autumns." There are many ways to find successive autumns in Arizona. Drive north, climb a mountain, or hike down a canyon. From September to January, it's always autumn if you know where to look. This year, I've been looking hard for signs of the season, though it is not difficult to find fall in any retail establishment, where, as the 105-plus degree days accumulated in September, my interest in pumpkin spice anything spiked, and I placed these symbols of fall in my cart as though to will the season along. I had not realized how much I was doing this until one afternoon in the checkout line, a cashier volunteered that they would not be reordering some of these pumpkin products given the time it would take to restock them. I looked at my cart. No wonder they thought I needed a heads up that the pumpkin party was coming to an end. Perhaps it was the crimson-red maple tree in front of my childhood home in Rhode Island, and the pink shadows it cast on my pale bedroom wall in the afternoon light, or the trips to apple orchards that solidified my love of all things autumn in a time before pumpkin spice was a latte. Over a decade ago, Still relatively new to Arizona, I discovered the thrill of exploring the forests atop Mount Lemmon, wandering among Big Tooth and Rocky Mountain maples in shades of orange, yellow, and reds that rivaled those back east. In recent years, it has not been so easy. Depending on the strength of the monsoon and the duration of hot temperatures in August and September, increasingly, my leaf excursions have turned up maples with sickly brown leaves dried on the branches, or, at best, a muted, tepid version of what had in years past appeared as a vibrant stained glass mosaic in a cathedral. I often find myself amidst trees at other times of year thinking about how they will look in autumn. As the season approaches, I become increasingly attuned to the state of the leaves until I have spent sufficient time amidst the colors, aromas, and relief of cool air. I am drawn to aspen groves that evoke the architecture of rooms. The yellow floors composed of freshly dropped leaves, white walls of trunks, and a blue ceiling of sky. Recently, I bounded into one of these rooms only to stumble upon a man seated in a chair, his coat hanging from a branch. He looked over and smiled, and I apologized as I exited, as though I had barged into his living room. On another excursion this season, I encountered a couple taking photos. They informed me that, according to the visitor center on Mount Lemmon, it was still another week or so until peak foliage. The woman added helpfully, "The smell of autumn isn't here yet." I thanked her for confirming what I noticed. While wandering among some brightening trees and appreciating the supporting role of the understory shrubs lending many shades of yellow to the scene, I had not yet been struck by that alchemy of innumerable decomposing leaves yielding olfactory gold. Sometimes, I fantasize that, like the birds in George Eliot's letter, I could follow the fall, chasing aspens wherever they are. I'm thankful that my friend Ben, an ecologist with a particular interest in aspens, encourages these flights of fancy. We speculate on the extremes of locations where one could find quaking aspens. In August, I would seek out the northernmost aspens in an Alaskan boreal forest. Then I would look for yellows, golds, and rusty oranges in the mountain ranges of British Columbia and Alberta, before following the Rockies down to New Mexico by early October. I would hop across the Sky Islands, searching for isolated pockets of old-growth aspens, as well as the thick young stands generated by recent fires. I would seek out aspen outposts, clinging to canyon walls, surrounded by chaparral, possible remnants of the last ice age. I'd cross the border in time to see thick-billed parrots amidst the groves of northern Chihuahua before they head south. My search for the southernmost quaking aspen would follow the Sierra Madre Occidental to the central Mexican highlands. This fantasy trip prompts me to think about the connections between these different populations. Connections that are increasingly clearer thanks to researchers like Ben Blonder at UC Berkeley, who map their genetics and search for traits that might promote resiliency as the cooler microclimates upon which aspens depend become increasingly rare. It is unlikely I will ever follow the arc of quaking aspens from the top to the bottom of North America. Fortunately, I do not need to travel far to celebrate months of changing colors. I can enjoy aspens on Mount Graham and Mount Lemmon from September through October. Maples in the Galeeros and Huachucas in November. And blazing yellow cottonwoods in desert canyons close to Tucson well into the new year. A delightful denouement to a delicious autumn. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Rebecca Doyle.
Tucsonan Rebecca Doyle has many published articles, stories, and essays that spring from her outdoor adventures. Her five-word motto is write, bike, hike, paddle, bird. Birdwatching is one of our state's most popular outdoor activities. And next, Tony Paniagua will talk with author and avid birder Richard Catcher Taylor about his book, A Field Guide to More Than 500 Arizona Native Species, including 17 varieties of hummingbird and a lot of new observations about their activities.
Rick Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
You have been in Arizona since you were 4 years old, and you've lived in, or you actually live in, a really nice spot. Can you tell us about that location and how that has led to your love or helped in your love of birds?
Well, I've actually dwelt in southeastern Arizona my entire life. Since I was in my early 20s, over 50 years now, I hate to say that, I have been in the Chiricahua Mountains. It's gorgeous. I have black bears and mountain lions and a lot of wild deer and javelina and various other critters show up outside my windows with surpassing regularity.
When did the feathered critter show up in your life, and why did you take such a liking to birds?
I used to work for the Forest Service in a long, long time ago in a distant galaxy, and I was a visitor contact specialist. And the largest clientele that we have in the Chiricahuas, especially on the portal side, the eastern side of the Chiricahuas in Cave Creek Canyon, are bird watchers, where we get tens of thousands every year hoping to see elegant trogons and red-faced warblers, painted red starts, a polychrome variety of birds. And these people were the nicest and smartest and most environmentally sensitive user group by far and away that I ever contacted. And I began to think of them as something to look forward to. And I wanted to be useful to them. I wanted to hold up my end of the conversation. About age 22, I became intense about learning something about birds, particularly the elegant trogon, and went on with Forest Service's blessing on an 8-year campaign to understand everything about the ecology of elegant trogons. That led me south into the tropics and into looking at bird communities as whole entities. I went from being a beginning birder who loved birds to actually leading tour groups.
And not only have you become a lover of birds, but you've also written about them. The reason you're here is because your most recent book, Birds of Arizona, is just out. Can you tell us about that book, please?
It's the book that I always wanted. I always wanted a book that was a handy reference with pictures and maps and elevations, the seasons at which birds occurred and how abundant they were within the season. This book is sort of a dream that I started having in my early 20s and actually found time to write and draw the maps during the pandemic.
And what do you think about those of us who live in this state? How lucky are we when it comes to the bird world? Because I know, for example, that we have some of the highest number of species in the United States.
We do. Only Texas and California actually have more birds. They're substantially larger than Arizona, and they have coastlines, which we don't quite have the benefit of. We come close. We're only 35 miles away from the outlet of the Colorado River into the Sea of Cortez. Yeah, we do very well, and we do particularly well with hummingbirds. We've had 17 species in recent history. And tropical birds overall. We're the northern apex of the Sierra Madre, the northern apex, really, of the Sonoran Desert and the Chihuahuan Desert. And we have a substantial influence from the Great Basin Desert, from the Rocky Mountains, and from the Great Plains. So you might consider Arizona a geographic axis for North American biomes.
And your bird guide will help people if they're out there in different areas of the state?
It should help people anywhere in the state of Arizona. All of the regularly occurring and most of the rarities, especially tropical rarities are given a full treatment with pictures, text, the seasonality, range map, showing in color the seasons where birds occur in which area of Arizona, and even the elevations so that you can zero in on the habitats that are also described. Probably the most unique feature of this book are the seasonal range maps for the species that occur here, something that's really never been done. A number of preceding books have had range maps for breeding species, like the Arizona Breeding Bird Atlas. But really, there had been nothing like this. And through eBird, which is a global bird listing platform hosted by Cornell, I could sift through observations and their maps. And this book presents the same information without making five or six computer queries. This compresses all of that data, plus a couple hundred thousand of my own sightings, into pretty easily understood maps. And that's something that's never been attempted before for all of the regularly occurring and most of the rare birds found in the state of Arizona.
We beat them because we can use the internet, but they can fly. So it's a good idea to pay attention to these birds, and not only birds, of course, but other wildlife out there. They can surprise us with some very interesting behavior.
Much of what we know, I think, about human behavior comes from observation of wildlife. And birds in particular are the easiest form of wildlife to observe because they're diurnal and they do a lot of things that humans do. They like to chatter. They put on nuptial plumage when they go a-courting. They select mates based on a variety of criteria that humans use as well. They live in houses they construct themselves. So, yeah, we get a lot of insights into social dynamics amongst humans by close observation of birds.
And finally, Rick, I don't want to get too philosophical with you here, but have birds changed your life? Do you feel blessed to have had this affinity, this love for our winged neighbors?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. No, birds enabled me to travel the entire world on the platform of my bird tour company, which is Borderland Tours. I met wonderful people from a huge variety of cultures all over the world. And I got to see most of the megafauna of the planet, tigers and gorillas, lions, you name it. It really was a wonderful way to experience the world and to learn about communities of life.
Tony Paniagua spoke with author and birding enthusiast Richard Catcher Taylor. Taylor's book is called Birds of Arizona, published by the R.W. Morse Company. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show is a production of AZPM. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. Production assistance by Sophia Hammer. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
AZPM's original productions are made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by donations from listeners like you. Learn more at support.azpm.org. Thank you.